This episode has been brought to you by Sake Man, a group of sake superheroes bringing sake to the world.
Hi guys, I'm Jamie Oliver and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network, a member-supported podcast network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. This year, HRN is celebrating 10 years of food radio. How amazing. For the past decade, they've been taking you behind the scenes of farms, restaurants, breweries, school cafeterias, and so much more. It's been 10 years, and they're just getting started. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
You're listening to Feast Meets West, the show tracing the stories behind your favorite Asian foods. I'm your host, Linda Liu. We are broadcasting live from Heritage Radio Network at Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Every episode, we dig deep on an aspect of Asian cuisine by having a conversation with the passionate people from the world of Asian food. I want to start out today by saying Happy New Year, dear listeners. For our first episode of 2019, we are bringing on our first historian to the show. Professor Q. Edward Wang wrote the first comprehensive book in English on the cultural and culinary history of chopsticks. So we've talked about so many of our favorite Asian dishes on this show. And now we're finally talking about the ultimate utensil that delivers those foods to our mouths. So more than one-fifth of the world's population use chopsticks as their primary eating utensil. So that's over 1.5 billion people. In his book, Professor Wang charts the evolution of chopsticks from a simple eating implement to their status as a more complex cultural symbol today. And our esteemed guest was born and raised in Shanghai, and he received his education in both China and the US. He has been a professor at Rowan University for over 2 decades, specializing in Asian history. His main research area is the study of how history is written from a cross-cultural perspective, and his writing of the history of chopsticks shows how history can be written from below, say from a food and material culture perspective. So welcome, Edward. We're delighted to have you on the line with us.
Well, the pleasure is mine. Thank you, Linda.
So let's start by hearing from you, what prompted you to write this book?
Well, basically two reasons. The first reason is scholarly reason that in recent decades, historians like us begin, you know, shifting our attention from the elite or the accomplishments of political leaders to the common people. So we hope to show that, like the great men, common folks also played a part in changing history. So writing the history of chopsticks enabled me to look at the role of a daily utensil in our life over the centuries. The second reason is that, it's a more personal reason, is that we as a family, even living in the United States for over about 3 decades, eat mostly Chinese food mm-hmm. at home. So, of course, the best tool, you know, in our belief and also in our practice, chopsticks are the most convenient implement. So then I would like to teach my son how to use chopsticks and hope to find a menu, but I am not able to find one, so that really prompted me to look for information on the history of chopsticks and then eventually led me to write a book myself.
That's great. So given that you've taught your son how to use chopsticks now, can you describe the correct way of holding chopsticks?
Yes, sure. I mean, the key to me, I think the key to hold, not just to me, but to every chopstick user, to hold chopsticks well and use them effectively is to leave some space between the two sticks on one end, usually the top end, and so you can close them on the other end at the bottom, so when you clutch food. For that purpose, you need to hold the bottom stick. You have two sticks, right? The bottom stick stable, placing it between your ring finger and the part of between of your index finger and the thumb. So stable, no move for the bottom stick. Then you use your middle finger, index finger, as well as the top of your thumb to move the top stick, as if you are holding a pen, it's like you use a pen. So when you transport food, you only move the top stick to touch the lower stick in order to grasp.
Yeah, very efficient and sturdy that way.
That's right.
So let's start from the beginning then, and understand why chopsticks became the most used utensil for eating, especially in Asia. What were the first forms of chopsticks identified? When and where was this?
Well, that's an extra long history. The first sample of chopsticks discovered in China was supposedly in a Neolithic cultural site, which dated between 6,000 BC to about 5,000 BC.
Wow.
So it's about 7,000 years ago. Yeah. That's for the archaeologists. They identified these 42 sticks of those bone-made sticks. They call them the first, say, sample of chopsticks. But my guess through my research was that these sticks were mostly for cooking instead of for eating.
Ah.
So there was a long kind of process of transformation that in the beginning, maybe they used for cooking to stir food in a pot or in a wok.
Mm.
And then maybe they gradually, the chef or the cook began to use those sticks to taste the food as well. And eventually...
Very natural progression.
That's right. So eventually, maybe, you know, after centuries, then the chopsticks eventually became the eating tool.
Yeah, so let's talk about some of those milestones in terms of how the chopsticks took hold as the most popular eating utensil and then even strengthened over time. Was it affected by changes in diets? What are some examples of that?
Well, yes. The subtitle of my book is called A Cultural and a Culinary History, that I look at two factors that made chopsticks the most used tool. The culinary side is that for the ancient Chinese, as well as the today's Chinese, there's a preference for eating food hot. They would like to eat food. How about when you use a tool that will not burn your fingers?
Right.
Yeah, we actually noticed that when we drink coffee, we can drink hot coffee. But we hold a coffee cup. Sometimes the cup can be too hot. So the hand cannot handle very hot temperature. So that's one of the reasons that the utensils were invented to hold the food, to transport the food for us.
Got it. And then is it because of the like regional and like weather kind of that affected why the Asian countries preferred hot food?
Yeah, well, then in that case, then we also need to consider the cultural factors.
Mm.
When I said that in North China, where chopsticks were found initially, the weather there pattern was indeed pretty dry and also cold. And so the people like to drink, to eat food hot as well as to drink some kind of soupy food. So chopsticks and spoons were invented for that purpose. But then for people living in, say, Vietnam and also in Japan, they don't have this preference for eating food hot. So why they adopted the custom of using chopsticks for food was mostly due to the cultural influence from China.
Got it. Yeah, so you referenced the chopsticks cultural sphere quite a bit in your book. Could you describe a little bit more how that formed and what Asian countries are included in this?
Yeah. Well, I would say the core in that zone, in the cultural sphere, was, of course, China, North China. And there we did not have much material from the southern part of China, but we have enough archaeological digs as well as the historical sources, the written documents that show that the chopsticks originated in North China. Then gradually, it's, I would say, the sphere expand. I would say mostly due to the influence of the Tang Dynasty. Tang Dynasty dates from 618 to 907. And that time that China has really experienced a golden period, then gradually, I would say, this type of culture began to exert its influence in the whole region. That includes today China, of course, mainland China, Vietnam, Korean Peninsula, Japanese archipelago, and also regions in Tibet, Mongolia, and some parts of Southeast Asia as well.
Got it. And what exactly happened during the Tang Dynasty? What was so powerful during that time frame?
Yeah. Well, historical sources show that during the time, the people living under the Tang Dynasty were also pretty open-minded and cosmopolitan to some degree. They traveled to many parts outside of their own, say, territory.
Wow.
And they found out, they mostly make comments on how people eat, outside of the Tang territory. They were mostly commenting on, oh, their people use hands, and so on. So this is the cultural sort of like a divide. And then I would say the people in the other regions also try to learn from the Tang culture. For example, the Japanese rulers from even before the Tang time, the early 7th century, already sent embassies to China to learn about almost everything, architecture, food, and even entertainment, like a certain type of drama and so on. So almost everything that they stayed in China for maybe several years or so, then came back. And we have records provided by the Japanese scholars that these embassies really taught Japanese how to use utensils to transport food.
Oh, very interesting. Yeah, the scale of that is just so amazing because all of this happened thousands of years ago. So let's talk about some of the differences within these Asian countries and how the chopsticks look and how they're used. Could you describe some of the main differences of chopsticks within each country? So I'm thinking differences in length or shape or, placement of where they're put on the table.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's very good. Actually, I found in my research, about in five areas, chopstick users in the same zone differ in their use of the tool.
Mm.
But I would say before the Tang Dynasty, possibly there was only one way of using them. But then after the Tang Dynasty, there were a lot of historical changes. So the first area was whether the tool, the chopsticks, are used together with a spoon. For Japanese, for Vietnamese, and for Southern Chinese, usually they can just use chopsticks to finish a meal. But for the Koreans, then they tend to have both. So in other words, that if you go to Korea, you cannot just buy a pair of chopsticks. You go to a supermarket and so on, you will buy a whole set that is a spoon as well as a pair of chopsticks together. They only sell in a whole set.
Oh, interesting. How is it that Koreans are different and they held on to the spoon?
Yeah, well, that's actually possibly my guess. So one thing is that when I say that during Tang Dynasty or before, there was only way of using the tools. What I meant was that the people then used both the spoon and the chopsticks. So that was reflected a cultural tradition or historical tradition.
Mm.
And then I think the Koreans also experienced the two invasions. One invasion was from the Mongols, the other was the Manchu from Manchuria. And maybe because of these two invasions, they held more kind of steadfastly to the original Chinese cultural form. So So in the Chosen Dynasty, which starting from 1390 to about 1910, this long rule of the dynasty, that there was a kind of a project or a program to revert to the originality of Chinese culture. So they emphasize on using both the spoon as well as the chopsticks. The spoon was mainly for carrying the grain food, and the chopsticks were only for carrying the non-grain food, say the dishes. But then there was also the length of chopsticks in the same cultural sphere varied. Say, when people go to Japan, they will find that Japanese people use shorter chopsticks, and the people in China use longer chopsticks.
Huh.
The length mainly because, I would say, from the 12th century or the 14th century onward, people in China as well in Korea and in Vietnam began to share food. So when you share food, then longer chopsticks became more convenient. And also that affected the third area, which is the placement. When you share food and the food are placed in the center of the table, the chopsticks are going to be placed vertically, pointing to the food. And if you have the food served to you into your, let's say, bento box, like we go to a Japanese restaurant, then the chopsticks were usually placed horizontally. And so the food will, I mean, and there was also no need to make chopsticks longer because the food was already given sort of like to you. So you carry the food from the bento or the individual plate to your mouth. So that'll be easier. The fourth area would be their shape. And most chopsticks are taped off at the bottom, so that'll be a little bit easier to carry food. But the Japanese chopsticks are a little bit pointy. The reason was that the Japanese eat more fish. So they use chopsticks to separate the fish bones from the fish meat. So pointing chopsticks could be a little bit more convenient tool. And the last area, the fifth and the last area, was what chopsticks was made of.
Oh, the materials.
But, yeah, the material. Majority of chopsticks, just like we show in the form of writing in Chinese, and they always have this wood or bamboo radicle. But then in Japan, they mostly use only the wooden chopsticks. But on the other hand, in other parts of the cultural sphere, there was tendency for the rich people to use expensive materials, like precious metals like gold, silver, and of course also ivory, jade, and ebony even. Oh, and also some very rare kind of wood to show off their social status.
Wow. Yeah, it seems like a lot of this just came from, you know, practical developments. It makes a lot of sense when you talk through them. I'm interested to hear how the Chinese and also Koreans developed communal style eating, whereas in Japan, they did not during that time.
Well, to me, I think there are mainly two reasons for people to share food. I mean, not two reasons, two causes for people to share food. One, of course, is the cause that they would like to eat different kind of dishes in one meal, in one sitting. But that has some relationship with the population growth. So from the 12th century onward, despite the interval of the Mongol invasion, population in Asian mainland grow. And particularly from the 15th century on, there was a major kind of population growth. And then the family size became larger, so people began to have like one table which was not made before. But from the 14th century, that table became popularly used in Chinese and also Korean families. That was called a table of eight immortals. Immortal, of course, referred to people. So that was like, basically the table is big enough to sit eight people. So you can see the family size also became bigger. So they cook like four or five different dishes. And
yeah, you're catering to different tastes on that table.
Exactly.
Plus, sharing is caring.
Yeah. So, but then of course, when you say the table, then in Japan before, say, 1868, before the Meiji Restoration, before Japan became modernized, the Japanese people actually have not used table and the chairs in their household. Table and chairs were invented actually by the nomadic people, and it gradually spread to China. So from the Tang Dynasty on to Song Dynasty, around the 12th century and so on, the people on the mainland began to use a table and a chairs. And so they sit up. Mm-hmm. But the Japanese, until the modern times, tend to sit on the floor. And they have the tatami, you know, it's like the bedding. So after food and during night, they would spread the beddings out on the floor.
Yeah.
But in daytime, they would roll up the bedding. So the floor was really like their table.
Mm-hmm.
So when you sit on the floor to eat food, it's a little bit difficult to share food.
Yeah, you don't want to reach over and spill something.
Exactly. I mean, if the food is in the center of the room and there's some kind of distance you have to cover, so it's a little bit more difficult. But if you, when you sit up on chairs and also the food is placed on the table, definitely that will also will facilitate this food sharing process.
Yeah, very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess given that there is a lot of sharing, and you're in a communal space, are there certain etiquettes, I guess, one should follow in using chopsticks?
Definitely.
What are some standard, so to speak, rules?
Yeah, well, the most, I would say, several of them. And I would say you don't use chopsticks, like, say, the first taboo is that even though chopsticks were very nimble, flexible, you can pick up food items almost at ease.
Even a peanut.
Even a peanut, yeah. But on the hand, it's a big taboo to mine the food in the plate.
Ah, like dig
in,
for
in
it.
In the bowl. I mean, that would be considered kind of very rude. And also, of course, you pick up the one food item already and you put them back. So that would be also considered rude, right? And I mean, so to me, I think even though we don't have much record about whether people were concerned about hygiene or not, but I would say those etiquettes show that the people are, even in pre-modern times, more concerned about eating kind of neatly,
mm-hmm.
not mess up with the food. So I would say that was the one thing. But the other thing is that chopsticks usually in the whole cultural sphere are not supposed to stand vertically in the bowl, which would be considered very bad. For the Japanese, that is basically, that was almost a symbol of death, because when a person is dying, the family would serve him or her a last bowl of rice with chopsticks standing standing in the bowl.
Got it. Wow.
But for other people, say, particularly like people believing Buddhism, this pair of chopsticks stand vertically in the bowl stands for like incense burning.
Mm-hmm.
But incense burning was mostly also for mourning the dead.
Yeah. So let's talk about that too, because it sounds like beyond just being a food utensil, chopsticks have made their way into these cultural symbols and, you know, being incorporated into ceremonies, or just like there are certain things you should do or shouldn't do, or like how to use them at weddings. Could you talk a little bit more about like some examples of how they're used as symbols or in ceremonies?
Yeah, some scholars possibly pointed out that the very origin of chopsticks was possibly had something to do with religious ceremonies. Maybe because those ceremonies were so sacred and holy that people don't want to use their hands to transport food, so they decided to use utensils. So that could be one very important reason. But then the other one is like, compared with other utensils, chopsticks were unique in the sense that they have to be used in a pair, right? So it's, and also they cannot be separated. So that became a very good gift for the newlyweds.
For couples, right?
Yeah, for the couples. You can also possibly put on a feminist reading that even though man and wife are different, but you should treat with equal respect because chopsticks have to be in the equal length. They have to work together.
Yeah, I like that.
then, of course, there's another popular custom for giving chopsticks at the weddings was chopsticks were pronounced from the 14th century on as kuaizi. Kuaizi was similar to born a child soon. So the meaning is to born a child soon. So that means to wish the newlyweds to have a child as soon after their wedding and so on. So this is a good wish.
Yeah.
Well. But on the hand, in other regions, because chopsticks are pronounced differently, so you don't have that. But throughout the region, I have to emphasize that chopsticks are a symbol of love, happy life, collaboration. And some people also use chopsticks to refer to straightforwardness, moral integrity. So you have a lot of poems and also essays describing chopsticks as a cultural metaphor.
Wow, that's so rich. So we're going to take a really quick break and we'll be right back with more Feast Meets West.
This episode is brought to you by Sake Man. What is Sake Man? Sake Man are judo athletes wearing Lucha Libre-inspired masks that act as sake heroes. This team of athletes moonlight as sake educational professionals spreading sake to the world. Learn more about their mission and their favorite sakes at saketotheworld.com. That's saketotheworld.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Feast Meets West. So, Edward, let's talk about some of the modern developments around chopsticks and how they moved from the East to the West.
Mm-hmm.
So what brought chopsticks to the Western Hemisphere?
I would say the two types of food. One was the Chinese takeout or Chinese takeaway. And that became very popular in the post-war period. After the 1960s and so on, you know, before 1960, when people study the history of Chinese restaurant in America or in Britain, they found that essentially there was the most typical food dish was chop suey. Chop suey is basically like a stir fried everything pudding. And we have actually two books both on the history of Chinese restaurant in the West, both actually entitled Chop Suey. But after 1960s, then people, the customers outside of China also developed more interest in eating Chinese food. And then you have a lot of takeout places. And when they actually serve food to people, for people to pick up the food, they will usually place like two pairs of disposable chopsticks in the bag for them to use. And now, of course, if you watch TV, if you care for like a watch of the TV programs, all those popular TV programs like Seinfeld, like Friends, and so on, you will see scenes of people using chopsticks to eat Chinese food from the box, the takeout box. Yeah. But that's the first wave. I would say the first wave. The second wave occurred a little bit later, but was more like a recent. That is the popularity of sushi, Japanese sushi. Definitely Japanese sushi, I would say, that really made the chopsticks the only tool for people to eat that type of dish. Because you can use maybe noodle to eat Chinese, to use like a fork to eat Chinese noodles and so on. But you cannot really use fork to eat Japanese sushi. You will break them. And it's very difficult. You have to clutch them carefully and place them in the saucepan before moving them into your mouth.
Yep, dip the soy sauce. There's a lot going on there. And who do we credit for coming up with disposable chopsticks?
Okay, my research shows that the Japanese could be the inventors of disposable chopsticks. The history was not very long. I would say around like the 17th century and so on. They became very popular in the Shinto shrines. Again, this just like we talked about before, that the chopsticks were used in religious ceremonies. So in the Shinto ceremonies, the priest usually would use actually pretty long pair of chopsticks to serve food afterwards.
Mm.
And then after the ceremony, they would throw away the chopsticks. And now the Japanese also the common folks in Japan also when they use those special type of chopsticks for the festivals, and they would also throw them away.
Why do they have to throw them away?
Well, that's also reflected in the Shinto belief that Japan was considered the land of the kamis. Kami are the deities. So once the Japanese actually believe that once you use chopsticks and the chopsticks touch your mouth, after meal you wash them, but your spirit would remain on the tips of the chopsticks. So the best way for your spirit or your soul to reunite with the deities in the world was to break chopsticks into half and throw them into the natural world, I guess. That was the best way of communication.
Oh, wow.
So the Japanese also believe that using wooden chopsticks will carry one person's spirit to another place. For example, if family, the father went to the war, and then the family miss him, but they will also, when they eat, they will get his pair of chopsticks on with them together. They saw that this is like serving as a bridge for the souls to connect each other. So that's why the chopsticks in Japan, in Japanese language, are pronounced the same as bridge.
Wow, like the bridge to someone's soul.
Exactly.
Wow, that's really powerful stuff. So another very interesting development that is quite popular here in Chinese American restaurants is the Lazy Susan. So I read in your book that had something to do with chopsticks and the communal eating experience as well. Could you talk a little bit about the Lazy Susan story?
Yeah, sure. Invented according at least according to the inventor, who was named Wu Liande. Wu Liande grew up in overseas Chinese communities. Then he went to Cambridge,
and so is he a Chinese person?
He was a Chinese person. Then he received his medical training in England. Then he went back to China in the early part of the 20th century and played a major role in. Popularized the idea of food hygiene and so on among the people.
Mm.
So he saw that sharing food with chopsticks was not so hygienic.
Yeah.
And then he he invented this Lady Susan so the dishes, because he thought it's difficult to change people's habit of sharing food, eating like several dishes in one meal. So he saw that the Lady Susan was a better solution. That is, you can place your dishes on the Lady Susan. The people can still share, but on each dish, you will have a pair of serving chopsticks for people to use them to move to transport the food items from the common bowl to your own bowl, and then they use your personal pair of chopsticks. So that means this Lady Susan provided this solution, he believed.
Very interesting. So I want to know what's next for the chopsticks. Do you predict that, this chopsticks cultural sphere is growing? Will there be more primary chopsticks users over fork and knife users or those who eat with their hands?
Well, definitely. I have pretty big kind of hope that Chaps's culture sphere is going to grow. I mean, and we have seen it actually day by day. You live in New York City, and in New York City, in Chinese restaurants, I mean, those restaurants not only serve Chinese customers, of course, or Asian customers, they also serve non-Asian customers. And you can see that in those Chinese restaurants, and most customers would use Chaps's to eat food. So you can see already, I mean, the sphere is expanding and growing. On the other hand, when we talk about Chaps's cultural spheres, scholars also point out that there are two other spheres, eating cultural spheres. Mm-hmm. That will be the fork and knife sphere, mm-hmm. as well as the finger feeders. Mm-hmm. So the finger feeders, using hands to eat. But from the recent decades and so on, you can see that the finger feeders sphere became kind of smaller. Right. More and more people began to adopt Western cutlery.
Yeah.
To eat their food. But the cultural sphere remains intact and also growing because, again, thanks to two types of Asian food. One is the Chinese food, the other is the Japanese food, Japanese hibachi, sushi, and mm-hmm. so on. But noodles also play a major role. I mean, in all the Chinese restaurants, or in other Asian restaurants too, noodles are a very popular dish. So noodles can be only eaten with either a pair of chopsticks or a fork.
Kind of a fork-spoon combo, yeah. Like the Italians.
That's right, yeah, yeah. I can add, as a matter of fact, that for the Westerners, for the Europeans, to use utensils was due to the influence or due to the spread of the so-called the noodle kind of a complex, the noodle popularity. That was as late as the 14th century onward.
Yeah, that was like the rise of wheat and flour products then.
Exactly.
Would you say there are any possible improvements for the chopsticks, or are they just perfect?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, not that I can think of. But on the other hand, I think the overseas Chinese restaurant really did a good job. I mean, traditionally, they have their paper set. I mean, this paper as the mat on the table, and usually they will have these illustrations to teach people how to use chopsticks. And the other thing, of course, the Chinese have their own pride. It's almost like you come to our restaurant, you want to eat our food, then you also adopt this custom. So they would not provide fork and a knife unless you ask them, right? So that means many customers are out of politeness would try to use chopsticks. And my theory is
that's
really
a good strategy.
the other theory that I think is that even though it can be a little bit difficult for the first-time users, chopsticks are not too difficult for people to learn about. So in other words, that chopsticks, the cultural sphere, grow over the centuries, from at least the 7th century onward. It was because this custom was not so hard to be learned for people outside of that sphere. So I believe, that's my hope, that the chopstick culture sphere will remain intact and also grow.
Yeah. So it sounds like it was a really fun project for you to write this book. What are you working on now? Are there going to be similar projects in the works?
Yeah, actually, now I'm also, when I look at, as I explained, the popularity of sharing food and the population growth, and so my next project was going to look at the population growth, not only in Asia, but also around the world, and I particularly look at one phenomenon that was after Columbus discovered Americas, then the American, or the so-called New World crops. These are mainly four types of crops. They are all like easy growing crops, food crops. Mm. One is the corn or the maize, right? The second is the sweet potato. The third is the peanuts, and the fourth one, you know, it's a skip of my mind. Those new world crops really help the population growth around the world. So I would say when China became, say, the most populous nation, was of course due to the popularity of rice. But on the other hand, from the 15th century onward, the country really grew with sweet potato. Oh, the fourth one is the potato. So you have the white potato and the sweet potato. They are not botanically related.
Oh, I didn't even know that.
That's right. So this is these four types of food crops really help the population grow. So to some degree, I would try to argue that without those new world crops, then we wouldn't have...
We wouldn't be here right now.
Yeah, we wouldn't have modernization or industrialization and so on, because at that time we needed a factory system, we needed the laborers, we needed the workers and so on, and the population just grew. And that was, I mean, China could be three times. In Japan, from 18th century, also grew like 40% and so on. In England, grew like 100% from the, say, the 16th century to the 18th century. So it's impressive growth.
Yeah, and so integral to food. So that is incredibly interesting. I look forward to that. Okay, so before we wrap up the show, I will actually shoot off some quick fire questions for you. It's meant to be really fun and fast, and it's all kind of like food related. So please just share what comes to mind.
Okay.
Okay, so what are your favorite Asian dishes?
I love noodles, like the Japanese ramen, even though it's called Japanese ramen. But if you look at the origin of the noodle, actually it was brought by the Chinese to Japan.
Yeah.
In Yokohama.
And they made it their own and really perfected it. Wow.
That's right.
So do you like to cook?
Yes, I try. I mean, particularly stir frying, that was the quintessential the way of cooking Chinese food.
Oh, yeah. What is your signature dish, or what's your signature stir fry?
Well, I don't think I have one signature stir fry dish, but in general, I would like to have those meat cut into shreds and mixed with vegetables. This is, again, a very typical Chinese dish.
Yeah, perfect dish for chopsticks users.
Exactly. That's also my argument that why chopsticks became popular in use was because of the stir-fried dishes.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Yeah, and so Chinese New Year is coming up. Are you doing anything to celebrate?
Sure. Eat a lot, eat different kind of dishes and so on. Then afterwards, we try to be on diet.
So realistic. Yeah. Amazing. Well, thank you for all the answers and for the detailed history lesson, Edward.
Thank you.
I'm even more in awe of the humble chopsticks now. So major respect on that. And then that wraps up our show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Yes. And thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in. Happy Chinese New Year for those celebrating. Let's go, Year of the Pig. If I could have one thing this new year, it would be more ratings and reviews. So if you haven't already, please take a minute to leave us one wherever you get your podcasts. And we'll be back in a couple weeks, that's February 13th, with another awesome conversation from the world of Asian food.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. and we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.